Because of the war, Wegener's theory didn't attract much notice at first, but by 1920, when he produced a revised and expanded edition, it quickly became a subject of discussion. Everyone agreed that continents moved, but up and down, not sideways. The process of vertical movement, known as isostasy, was a foundation of geological beliefs for generations, though no one had any good theories as to how or why it happened. One idea, which remained in textbooks well into my own school days, was the baked apple theory propounded by the Austrian Edward Suess just before the turn of the century. This suggested that as the molten earth had cooled, it had become wrinkled in the manner of a baked apple, creating ocean basins and mountain ranges. Never mind that James Hutton had shown long before that any such static arrangement would eventually result in a featureless spheroid as erosion levelled the bumps and filled in the divots. There was also the problem, demonstrated by Rutherford and Soddy early in the century, that earthly elements hold huge reserves of heat, much too much to allow for the sort of cooling and shrinking Suess suggested. And anyway, if Suess's theory was correct, then mountains should be evenly distributed across the face of the earth, which, patently, they were not, and of more or less the same ages. Yet by the early 1900s it was already evident that some ranges, like the Urals and Appalachians, were hundreds of millions of years older than others, like the Alps and Rockies. Clearly the time was ripe for a new theory. Unfortunately, Alfred Wegener was not the man that geologists wished to provide it. For a start, his radical notions questioned the foundations of their discipline, seldom an effective way to generate warmth in an audience. Such a challenge would have been painful enough coming from a geologist, but Wegener had no background in geology. He was a meteorologist, for goodness sake. A weatherman, a German weatherman. These were not remediable deficiencies. And so geologists took every pain they could think of to dismiss his evidence and belittle his suggestions. To get around the problems of fossil distributions, they posited ancient land bridges wherever they were needed. When an ancient horse named Hipparion was found to have lived in France and Florida at the same time, a land bridge was drawn across the Atlantic. When it was realized that ancient tapirs had existed simultaneously in South America and Southeast Asia, a land bridge was drawn there, too. Soon, maps of prehistoric seas were almost solid with hypothesized land bridges, from North America to Europe, from Brazil to Africa, from Southeast Asia to Australia, from Australia to Antarctica. These connective tendrils had not only conveniently appeared whenever it was necessary to move a living organism from one landmass to another, but then obligingly vanished without leaving a trace of their former existence. None of this, of course, was supported by so much as a grain of actual evidence. Nothing so wrong could be. Yet it was geological orthodoxy for the next half century. Even land bridges couldn't explain some things. One species of trilobite that was well known in Europe was also found to have lived on Newfoundland, but only on one side. No one could persuasively explain how it had managed to cross 2,000 miles of hostile ocean, but then failed to find its way around the corner of a 200-mile-wide island. Even more awkwardly anomalous was another species of trilobite found in Europe and the Pacific Northwest, but nowhere in between, which would have required not so much a land bridge as a flyover. Yet as late as 1964, when the Encyclopaedia Britannica discussed the rival theories, it was Wegener's that was held to be full of numerous grave theoretical difficulties.